Welcome back. You're listening to Over the Rainbow, part two of the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley and Hollywood. It's part of the series Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson.
Are you a member of the Communist Party?
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
The House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, was established by Congress in 1937 to investigate, quote, subversive activities in the United States. In 1947, HUAC went after alleged communist influence in the motion picture industry. J. Parnell Thomas was chairman of the committee.
It is only to be expected that the elements would strive desperately to gain entry to the motion picture industry, simply because the industry offers such a tremendous weapon for education and propaganda.
After World War II, we entered into another war, which was the Cold War. And the greatest enemy in the world to America at the time seemed to be communism. Congress targeted all sorts of people and industries, most especially the motion picture industry. In some ways, because the business was run almost exclusively by Jews, I think in large measure it was a way of going after the Jews. And there has long been a kind of linking of the Jews with communism in this country and indeed around the world. And so it became a really ripe target.
Mr. Maltz, are you a member of the Communist Party?
Albert Maltz, a Jewish screenwriter, was one of the Hollywood Ten. He was blacklisted after he refused to cooperate with the committee.
Next, you are going to ask what my religious beliefs are, and you are going to insist before various members of the industry that since you don't like my religious beliefs, I should not work in that industry.
Mr. Maltz,
any such question is quite irrelevant to the course of this committee's investigation.
Mr. Maltz, I repeat the question. Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Certainly, there were a number of leftists there, mainly among the writers and to a lesser degree directors and actors. And the political climate was such in the United States that once you had politicians campaigning on the fact that the communists had tried to take over Hollywood and the idea that Hollywood was this dangerous center of Stalinist subversion.
It was not only anti-Hollywood, it was anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish. Rankin and those guys were known anti-Semites. There was no question about it. Nevertheless, the behavior of most of the studio heads who were Jewish was pretty despicable.
They thought, well, we can get rid of a few outspoken, loudmouth communist troublemakers. But of course, that just created a desire to find more subversives and more famous subversives in the industry to undergo a major house cleaning, let's say, to prove that it really was an American institution.
There was a ritual people had to go through to purge themselves, to clear themselves, and some did and some didn't. And tell us who exactly were the Hollywood Ten.
The Hollywood Ten were the first so-called unfriendly witnesses who were called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in October 1947. There were friendly witnesses, most famously Ronald Reagan and Robert Taylor, Jack Warner, Ayn Rand, and they testified to the power of communists in Hollywood. And then there were people subpoenaed who were, in fact, communists.
There were the Hollywood 19 at first, 19 people that were called to testify. Some of them were not communists. However, all of the 10 that were finally called to the bench were communists or had been, like I had been, but I wasn't at the time.
Edward Dmytryk directed the 1947 film Crossfire, one of the first movies to depict anti-Semitism. Dmytryk was one of the Hollywood 10. He was not Jewish, though 6 of the 10 were.
Next question, Mr. Stripling.
Mr. Bieberman, are you a member of the Screenwriters Guild, or have you ever been a member of the Screenwriters Guild?
Their strategy was to refuse to answer any questions and not take the fifth.
Now, Mr. Stripling, I would like to reply to this very quietly, Mr. Chairman Orford. If I will not be interrupted, I will attempt to give you a full answer to this question.
The logic was that if they were asked if they were communists and they said yes, it wasn't a crime then to be a communist, that they would be asked about who went to the meetings with you and to give lists of names, which people didn't want to do.
It has become very clear to me that the real purpose of this investigation...
That is not...
Mr. Biberman. Are you a member of the Communist Party? Are you now? Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
The Hollywood Ten went to jail for contempt of Congress because they wouldn't answer any questions.
Most of the moguls, when they were called to testify, knuckled under to prove that, above all, they were good patriots. And it's not that they were denying their Jewishness in any way. It was really, though, that they wanted to show that they were super patriots and that nobody was more American than they were.
Termites have burrowed into many American industries, organizations, and societies. Wherever they may be, I say let us dig them out and get rid of them.
Jack Warner, testifying at a HUAC hearing in 1947.
My brothers and I will be happy to subscribe generously to a pest removal fund. We are willing to establish such a fund to ship to Russia the people who don't like our American system of government and prefer the communistic system to ours. Subversive germs breed in dark corners. Let's get light into those corners. That, I believe, is the purpose of this hearing, and I am happy to have had the opportunity to testify.
There was really only one mogul that stood up to the Congress, and that was Samuel Goldwyn. He was the independent. He had the least to lose, and he found that he always succeeded by going in the direction everyone else wasn't.
The motion picture industry is often faced by pressures from narrow, ignorant individuals and groups. Some of them may have the best intention in the world, but it's a mistake to take their pressures lying down.
Samuel Goldwyn was called to testify before the House Committee on American Activities. And just before he was meant to testify, they changed their mind. They knew he was a loose cannon, and they simply sent him home.
When did Jews start coming out of the closet, as it were? When were Jewish themes no longer taboo?
After the war, of course, there were the two important films in 1947 about anti-Semitism, Gentlemen's Agreement and Crossfire, but really wasn't until, I think, the most important breakthrough film, 1960 and Exodus.
No, I just wanted you to know that I'm a Jew. This is my country.
It's a real coming out for the Hollywood community, not only for the full-blown recognition of the State of Israel, but the film is extremely Jewish. There's a marvelous scene in which Paul Newman is telling Eva Marie Saint, takes her to the top of a hilltop, and they look down on the valley. He says, you know, I'm Jewish. This is me. This is who I am.
People are different. They have a right to be different. They like to be different. It's no good pretending the differences don't exist. They do. They have to be recognized and respected.
I recognize them. I respect them. Don't you understand that you make me feel like a Presbyterian when you can't for just a minute or two forget that you're a Jew?
Remember, that's a 3-hour film, full-blown color, major production. The other important scene in that movie is referable to the Holocaust.
And you saved your own life by working in that camp as a Sonderkommando, correct? It was the duty of those Jews who became Sonderkommandos to shave the heads of other Jews.
Sonderkommando were the people who dealt with the dead bodies.
To remove dead bodies from the gas chambers. To collect gold fillings from their teeth.
Yes! What can I do?
It's a small scene that brings to the fore this almost taboo topic up until then. 1965 is also extremely, you know, important breakthrough. You've got A Pawnbroker that deals with the Holocaust in a very straightforward, raw production. You've got Mel Brooks coming out with The Producers in 1968, Springtime for Hitler.
Springtime for Hitler, right?
Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
People were outraged. It was just so brave and so satirical and so critical.
Look out, here comes the masquerade.
It was his way of, as he says, kicking the Germans in the ass.
Hitler was part of this incredible idea that you could put Jews in concentration camps and kill them. And how do you get even? There's only one way to get even. You have to bring him down with ridicule. It's been one of my lifelong jobs to make the world laugh at Adolf Hitler.
I was born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
I was in the army. This guy, you called me Jew boy. Out of my way, out of my face, Jew boy. And I walked over to him. I took his helmet off. I said, I don't want to hurt your helmet because it's a GI issue. And I smashed him in the head with my mess kit. Yes, I am a Jew. I am a Jew. What about it? What's the matter with being a Jew? I think there's a lot of that beneath all the quick Jewish jokes that I do. It may be a deep-seated anger at anti-Semitism.
As you move into the 70s, there's a beginning of a no longer hiding in the closet.
There was a kind of explosion of comic and assertive Jewish self-consciousness after all these years. And you saw it in a number of places by the end of the 60s when you had a kind of small but influential Jewish new wave. I mean, for the first time, really since the 1920s, there were a number of Jewish films, mainly comedies, but not all, that were made by Jews, directed, written by Jews, largely with explicitly Jewish characters, and the Jews were played by Jews. And in some cases, they were Jewish actors who didn't change their names. I mean, Dustin Hoffman.
Elliot Gould.
You could say that in a way, this begins with The Graduate. You know, the characters were not explicitly Jewish, but they were recognized as Jews.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
The Graduate fits perfectly in with a whole group of films. Goodbye, Columbus, 1969, Portnoy's Complaint, 1972, in which Jewish characters begin to examine and are critical of the materialism and the unethical behavior of Jews. It's okay to criticize other Jews if their behavior isn't acceptable. This is the beginning of the anti-war movement.
The great social movements of the 60s were about embracing one's minority status, whether it was your religion or your color or your gender.
This is the coming out of Black is beautiful and it's okay to be Jewish in America. You didn't have to be a part of the melting pot.
I think we entered a whole new era, not just in motion pictures, but in American culture. And we began to focus on identities. And so into the 60s, we have a whole new wave of stars who not only kept their Jewish names, but rather trumpeted them, whether it was Hoffman or Streisand.
I guess it's not funny. Life is far from sunny. When the laugh is over and the joke's on you.
Barbra Streisand's first Hollywood role was the screen version of Funny Girl, the biography of the Jewish comedian Fanny Brice.
When she made Funny Girl in 1968, there was a big question about whether or not this woman who was not looking like Marilyn Monroe would in fact be able to make it on the screen.
Is a nose with deviation such a crime against the nation? Should I throw her into jail or drown the cat?
Funny Girl is her initial starring role as a singer in a Hollywood feature.
Oh, God.
she, by the 1980s, has enough clout, enough power, and enough financial independence to be able to make the film that she wants to with Yentl.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me? Papa, can you find me in the night?
Yentl is a wonderful film that Streisand makes, stars in, directs, produces, writes, does everything, about a young woman who wants to study Talmud, but it's prohibited for women to study, so she pretends to be a man.
What if there was some crazy law that said old men called Avigdor, or old men with brown eyes, were forbidden to study? What would you do?
I'd study anyway.
Secretly?
If I had to, why?
It's sort of the culmination of a number of years of having to play roles that somebody else assigned to her.
My name isn't Antron. It's Yentl.
Yentl?
And I'm a woman.
There's a tradition among comedians and comedy writers of throwing in a joke that only three people would get. Yiddishisms infiltrating standard American culture.
There's a wonderful scene in Blazing Saddles. Mel Brooks starts speaking Yiddish, and I think he says, Lozim Gain, which means, you know, let him go, let him get out of here.
Lozim Gain! Kappa walk, it's all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Abigazin, take off.
The other really important and film that I absolutely adore is Frisco Kid. The two characters, Gene Wilder as the rabbi and Harrison Ford as the Western cowboy who's kind of on the edge of unethical behavior, become great pals and cross America together.
Well, it's nice meeting up with you, pard.
Nice meeting up with you, pard.
You got it straight?
Oh, sure. Right from this tree, I head straight north 5 or 6 weeks till I come to the flat country.
Through it all, thick and thin, he retains his Jewishness with a great deal of respect for his own traditions.
What the hell are you doing?
He won't eat non-kosher meat even though he's almost starving to death.
I don't ride today.
He doesn't ride his horse on the Sabbath.
Today is Saturday.
So?
I don't ride on Saturday.
Well, I know that, but don't tell me you ain't gonna ride today.
I ain't gonna ride today.
I asked you not to tell me that.
That's what I'm telling you.
But this ain't no ordinary Saturday.
By the 1970s, all of the sort of traditional genres, the Western, the gangster, the musical, they're all now open to very strong Jewish characterizations. The musical, you've got Fiddler on the Roof. The Western, you've got Frisco Kid. The gangster, you've got loads of those. You've got Bugsy.
Ben Siegel? You wouldn't be related to Bugsy Siegel, would you?
Bugsy? What do you mean, Bugsy?
Strong Jewish criminals come to the fore.
A bug is nothing. A bug does not exist. The word has no meaning. It's only used out of ignorance or malice. Do you know what a bug is? A bug is a colloquialism. It has no basis in reality. Insects include a wide variety of living creatures. They fly, they crawl, they do many things. None of them can be called a bug. Are you following me? Because
yes,
if you aren't...
I am. I certainly didn't mean any offense, Mr. Siegel.
Ben.
So now let's turn to Woody Allen.
Oh,
yes, sir, sure.
I'm really looking forward to tomorrow. I mean, you know, I think it'll be really nice. You'll meet mother and father.
Yeah, I know. They hate me immediately.
1977 Annie Hall is both hilarious but at the same time important film dealing with the desire of Jewish males to be with white American Protestant women.
It's a nice ham this year, Mom.
In this scene, Woody Allen's character, Alvy Singer, is invited to dinner by Annie Hall's parents. In the middle of the meal, he turns to the camera and delivers an aside.
I can't believe this family. The old lady at the end of the table is a classic Jew hater.
Alvy imagines himself as a Hasidic Jew. For a moment, he's transformed into a Hasid with a full beard and sidelocks. Then he imagines the Halls at dinner with his own family, the Singers.
How do you plan to spend the holidays, Mrs. Singer?
We fast.
Fast? You know, no food. You know, to atone for our sins.
What sins? I don't understand.
Tell you the truth, neither do we.
traditional Jews don't come off very well, nor do sort of the image of white American Protestants and his family. So he's got his knife out, it seems to me, for everybody in this particular film. One of my favorites of Jews in Hollywood who have progressed dramatically is Barry Levinson. Diner, Avalon, Tin Man. He was the director of the television series Homicide, Wag the Dog. Enough films, enough position, enough power to, I think, by 1999, makes Liberty Heights.
I grew up in the northwest section of Baltimore. It was all Jewish. In fact, I didn't even think of it in those terms. I just assumed everyone was Jewish.
Which is an absolutely marvelous, full-blown film about growing up Jewish in Baltimore with humor and a great deal of knowledge about what it means to be a Jew.
I began to sense there was a world beyond what I knew when I had lunch at Butch Johnson's house.
Is there something wrong, Ben?
There's too much white here. The milk is white. The bread is white. It's all white stuff.
Well, what do you normally have?
Not this.
So, from the Lower East Side Nickelodeons, run by Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, in many ways, the arc of that journey parallels almost precisely the arc of most of the Eastern European Jews. But where are we now in terms of Jews in Hollywood? Is Hollywood still a Jewish town?
Well, I think that there's certainly a large Jewish component in American show business in general, many directors, but also people who are involved in other aspects of filmmaking. And, you know, there's that Adam Sandler song, which was so popular about 10 years ago, where he's naming all the Jews for Hanukkah, and he says, Tom Cruise isn't Jewish, but I heard his agent is.
So many Jews are in showbiz. Tom Cruise isn't, but I heard his agent is. Tell your friend Veronica, it's time you celebrate Hanukkah.
But how many of the current directors, stars, studio heads have a Jewish consciousness?
Well, I guess it depends on how you would define that. And the thing is that to some degree, that's something which is put on people. I mean, I think that, you know, people have individual consciousness and it can be labeled as this or that. I mean, you have to say that America has been, for the most part, a good place for Jews, and the movie industry has been as well, so that Jews are free to work there even if they're not Jews. I mean, both as Jews and as something else.
And the Emmy goes to
the team from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. You know, when I first said that I wanted to put together a late-night comedy writing team that would only be 80% Ivy League-educated Jews, people thought I was crazy. They said you need 90, 95%. But we proved them wrong.
Hooray for Hollywood, that screwy, ballyhooey Hollywood.
You've been listening to Over the Rainbow, part two of the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley and Hollywood. This program is part of the series Only in America, 350 years of the American Jewish experience. The series was developed, written, and executive produced by Larry Josephson for the Radio Foundation. This program was produced by Larry Josephson, Sarah Elzis, and Sarah Parath. It was edited by Sarah Elzis. Our script consultant is Paul Fisher. Marty Goldenson is our resident radio doctor. We had help from Sarah Kramer, Adam Goodkind, Franny Carr, Eleanor Ostrinsky, Rosa Goldenson, Maisie Tivnan, Raylan Grogan, and Diana Green. Our historical consultant is Dr. Jonathan Sarna. The interviews were recorded by Bill Sigmund and Robert Auld. Post-production by David Rapkin and Robert Auld. A very special thanks to Nikki Newman Tanner. Thanks also to Bob Gill, who designed our logo, to my assistant, Deborah Sotopoulos, and to Andy Lancet, who runs the WNYC archives. Oral histories of Adolf Zucker, Samson Rafelson, and David O. Selznick are courtesy of the Columbia University Oral History Office. To hear this program or others in the series, and for information about podcasts, CDs, and transcripts, visit our website, onlyinamerica.info. Send your comments to only@radioart.org or call our comment line 212-595-2920. Only in America is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation. On the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide. On the web at frostzelnick.com. And from one anonymous donor. This is Larry Josephson.